What does the Bible say about how we should dress, what clothes we should wear? Are we permitted to wear makeup? Do we have to cover our faces, our heads, or wear old-fashioned clothing? Are Christians supposed to move along with the currents of fashion and culture, or are we to be left in the past, in the clothing of the 17th century? What does the Bible say about these things? Modesty is the topic of this lesson. Now, in the broadest sense, modesty refers to much more than just clothing. One definition, reserve or propriety in speech, dress or behavior, lack of pretentiousness. So it's much broader than what we wear, but that's a good place to focus. And this podcast will focus more on dress than anything else. And especially dress as in encouraging sexual attention, or drawing attention to oneself. But of course, a more developed discussion on modesty would follow similar lines in exploring speech and behavior and character and mannerisms and everything else. So here's the plan. We're going to begin with the scriptures. I'll be referring to several Old Testament passages. Then we'll read a number of New Testament passages. And then we're going to see what early church leaders wrote, particularly in the 2nd and 3rd centuries. We'll conclude with some reasons that we should be thinking about this seriously and how this applies to our lives. As I prepared for this lesson, I discovered a huge number of passages, and so I'm sure you'll be happy if I just refer to many of them. In one of the early passages on clothing, Tamar, in Genesis 38, telegraphs a message, in this case to Judah, that she was sexually available. The way she dressed, in this case, signaled that she was playing the part of a prostitute. And for more on that, you can read all of Proverbs 7, which explores the temptations and the snares of being drawn in and seduced. Job talks about making a covenant with his eyes, not to look lustfully at a woman, in Job 31. Women are affected visually, of course, but men far more. We notice things, especially when they're women, and men do notice how women are dressed. Ezekiel 16 also deals with a perversion of modesty into a form of seduction, and we see something similar in Ezekiel 22. And who could forget Habakkuk 2:15? Woe to those who, basically, the prophet is saying, try to get their neighbors drunk so they'll get undressed and they can look at their body parts. Habakkuk 2:15. Oh, the Bible is a completely realistic book. It has our number. God knows what's in our heads and what kinds of things people like to do. Well, Jesus, of course, says some very strong things in this area. You've heard it was said, do not commit adultery, but I tell you, Matthew 5:27 and 28, I tell you, anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart. Obviously, we don't look at a person lustfully if there's no person to see. So the question is not, do we cover up completely so that we're unrecognizable, or do we wear nothing at all? The extremes are just that, somewhat ridiculous. The wisdom we seek is, where is that middle ground? I mean, how much do we cover up? You know, everyone would agree, of course, we should be modest. But what does that mean? What is permitted? How much should we just follow the images we see on television and in films and in fashion magazines? Jesus' brother James has some good things to say about temptation and the process of temptation. And so much of this begins with a vision, something visual, or it could begin with a meditation, something we're thinking about. James 1:13, when tempted, no one should say, God is tempting me, for God cannot be tempted by evil, nor does he tempt anyone. But each one is tempted when, by his own evil desire, he is dragged away and enticed. And then, after desire is conceived, it gives birth to sin. And sin, when it is full grown, gives birth to death. So this is a process. The desire grows, and what begins perhaps as a random thought ends up in a temptation that can change our actions and thus our lives and even our destiny. Paul mentions in 1 Corinthians 12 the obvious, that some parts of the body are more modest than others and should be covered. But I'd like to read one of Paul's other passages in 1 Thessalonians 4. And usually we read this in the context of controlling our sexual appetites, building relationships with those of the opposite sex. But please listen to 1 Thessalonians 4, 4 and 5 in the light of modesty. I'll begin in verse 3. It is God's will that you should be sanctified, that you should avoid sexual immorality, that each of you should learn to control his own body in a way that is holy and honorable, not in passionate lust like the heathen who do not know God. The way we conduct ourselves with respect to sexual ethics has to be different from those ethics, if I can use that word, mores that we find in the world. Now, clearly, they will think, when we try to live by God's standard, they'll think that we have gone too far and may even heap abuse on us, as Peter warned in 1 Peter 4. But let's look at a couple more of Paul's passages. These will be key before we get into the patristic, into the church fathers, and prepare, you'll see what's coming. I don't know how popular this lesson's going to be, but I think we have to be willing to teach any subject that the Bible addresses. I'm in 1 Timothy chapter 2, where Paul has just said, I want men everywhere to lift up holy hands in prayer without anger or disputing. And he continues, verse 9, I also want women to dress modestly, with decency and propriety. And I can just pause right there. We know that what is proper in one culture may be improper in another, in a very obvious way. If you live in the Arctic, you're going to be much more covered up than if you live at the equator. And so we recognize there will be some differences. Again, where do we draw that line? So propriety will vary even depending on the climate and the culture. But what's decent, what's truly modest, is something deeper. It's something that's inside. And that beauty, that attractiveness, that winsomeness in women and in men should be coming not from what is outside, but what is inside. So let me continue this passage. Paul says he wants women to dress modestly, not with braided hair, or gold, or pearls, or expensive clothes, but with good deeds appropriate for women who profess to worship God. Well, this is one of those passages that many are tempted to say, well, that's obviously cultural, because we wouldn't want to do what he's saying. But before we just dismiss it, it's our task to figure out what he is saying. At this time, and this is the mid to late first century, who dresses with exquisite clothes and jewelry? Well, they would tend to be those of the upper class who are exploiting those of the lower class. So I think that's one thing to realize. People who are often not Christians will be dressing this way. And so we're not to emulate those who are taking us to court, as it says in James chapter 5, those who think that we've gone too far in our following of Christ, for whom the cross itself is scandalous. Well, is it wrong for us to have braided hair? This is not the way I read it. I believe Paul is saying that in his culture, braided hair was always or was often associated with immodesty. And the same thing with expensive clothes. The beauty comes from the inside. He mentions good deeds. And those are appropriate for women who worship God. So if you want to know my position, it's not that it's wrong to ever wear an earring or to take care of your hair, but people can go too far. I think we can get a pretty good idea just looking at the media, look in magazines or in the movies, at how women and men dress, how they make themselves up, deck themselves out. And very often, that's the example of what not to do. Because it's the heart that God looks at, 1 Samuel 16:7. It's the heart that matters. And if we're relying on these external things to be the source of winsomeness, handsomeness, beauty, we're doing something very wrong. Peter has a similar thought in 1 Peter 3 about winning over spouses who don't believe, in this case, non-Christian husbands. And it says that they may be won over by the behavior of their wives, 1 Peter 3:2, when they see the purity and reverence of your lives. The New American Standard says, as they observe your chaste and respectful behavior. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Now, that's very similar to what Paul said. In other words, the beauty shouldn't just be that. Instead, it should be that of your inner self, the unfading beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is of great worth in God's sight. For this is the way the holy women of the past who put their hope in God used to make themselves beautiful. And then Peter gives an example of Sarah. And one thing that strikes me, Sarah was not a poor woman. Abraham and Sarah, according to the book of Genesis, were quite wealthy. So she could have really turned it on with clothing and hair and jewelry, but she doesn't. She's modest. And then one other New Testament passage I would like to read before we look at what the early Christians taught about this subject in the writings called the Church Fathers or the Patristics. And I'm hoping this will be new to some because I think it's pretty eye-opening. The last passage we'll look at in the New Testament is in Romans 14. In this discussion of doing things that will cause others to fall, to stumble, maybe even to lose their salvation, we need to really watch ourselves. Romans 14, let's do 19 to, all the way to 23. Let us therefore make every effort to do what leads to peace and mutual edification. Do not destroy the work of God for the sake of food. All food is clean, but it's wrong for man to eat anything that causes someone else to stumble. It is better not to eat meat or drink wine or to do anything else that will cause your brother to fall. Paul's pointing out the dangers of things we may do in our freedom, the danger to our brother in Christ. So, whatever you believe about these things, keep between yourself and God. Blessed is the man who does not condemn himself by what he approves. But the man who has doubts is condemned if he eats, because his eating is not from faith, and everything that does not come from faith is sin. In other words, when we talk about Christian behavior, it's not just a matter of what I have a right to do, because I need to consider the other person. And if my behavior is causing someone else to stumble, not to complain, but to stumble, to fall into sin, then something is wrong. In our culture, we talk so much about the pursuit of happiness. And as long as I'm not hurting anyone, then whatever I want to do on my own, in the privacy of my own house, is my business. How different from the teaching of Jesus Christ, who urged us, as did all the great men and women of Scripture, to pursue holiness. Not happiness, but to pursue holiness. And often happiness is thrown in. Now, we leave the world of the New Testament, and we'll look at some passages that come from the next century, the second century. And there are some notes at my website, if you want to find all these, but I'll just read them without giving you the references in this lesson. One person we hear from is Clement of Alexandria, that is, from Northeast Africa. And Clement says that married women should be fully clothed by garments on the outside and by modesty on the inside. Now, we may think, well, what does fully clothed mean? Does it mean you're wearing a burqa, just your eye slits, or can they see anything? Well, I think we have a sense of, you know, get some clothes on. You know, you're not dressed or you are dressed. Whatever he means, the contrast he brings out is between external garment and internal. The modesty is what should be on the inside. By no manner of means are women to be allowed to uncover and exhibit any part of their person. Otherwise, both may fall, the men by being excited to look, the women by drawing to themselves the eyes of men. The way a woman dresses does affect men. I speak as a man, and nearly every man I know would speak from experience, that some women make it easy, some women make it very hard to keep our eyes focused straight ahead. We can be excited to look. Now, you might think, well, that's the guy's problem. Or if you reverse the situation, the way a man is dressing, well, if a woman's staring at me, that's her problem. But no, the Bible doesn't allow us to do that, that false sense of individualism and freedom. It says that we also fall. We sin if we cause others to look at us. And this is what Paul is saying in Romans 14. A little bit more from Clement. Women may be permitted to use softer clothes. He means softer than men, you know, more soft fabrics, provided they avoid fabrics that are foolishly thin. Luxurious clothing that cannot conceal the shape of the body is no more a covering. For such clothing, falling close to the body, takes the body's form more easily, and clinging to the body as though it were the flesh, it receives its shape and outlines the woman's figure, and as a result, the whole of her body is visible to spectators, although they cannot, technically, they cannot see the body itself. So he's talking about thin, clingy clothing. Of course they had it back then, and people used it. Christians were not to have anything to do with that. It's interesting to see there what they said. Clement also writes, neither is it seemly for clothes to be above the knee. Now, again, as a Bible teacher, I'm not trying to put out the message that a woman's skirt must come below the knee. In most cultures in the world, it better go below the knee. In some, it doesn't, and that's not immodest, but in many, it doesn't, and it is immodest. The point is that there is a line to be drawn. And I think as followers of Christ, we need to not be afraid to talk about these things. Clement also talks about cosmetics and what they do to the face. And he talks about women who turn their faces into masks. What does God think of spurious beauty, rejecting utterly as he does all falsehood? In other words, if you have so much makeup on that, you look like a totally different person, that's a form of deceit. Let the woman's garments be suited to age, person, figure, and pursuits. And we'll come back to that theme later on, that we should dress appropriately for our age. If you're 60, stop trying to look like you're 20. And not only does it make your children and grandchildren feel odd, it's just not right. Now listen to this one. I wondered whether I should even include this passage from Clement. He says, neither is the hair to be dyed, nor gray hair to have its color changed. Old age, which conciliates trust, is not to be concealed. Of course, we live in a culture where old age is shunted away, and people do everything they can through hair transplants and dyes and various procedures to look younger. Why would we do that? Old age is a beautiful thing. Now, biblically, it says that gray hair is a crown of, really, of righteousness, of honor. It suggests wisdom. Now, although I've said these things, I don't believe that it's absolutely wrong to dye one's hair. I don't do it. Maybe I don't do it because I don't have much hair. But actually, I like the silver look. I think that's great. But through so much of Christian history, this was completely rejected. You don't color your hair. You are who you are. Accept who you are. Be happy with who you are. Stop living in the past. And so they took the position that the hair should just be the color the hair is. I mean, how much easier would life be if we stopped pretending and trying to look younger? Think about that. Again, I don't think it's sinful I can't make a law where the Bible doesn't have a law. And this is not Bible. I'm simply reading from the patristic writers. But the principle of modesty applies. I just think these texts that I'm sharing with you are very fascinating, and they illustrate so much. One more from Clement. They must not do as some do, for some women imitate the acting of comedy. Okay, let me just pause here. I'm not saying they're always trying to crack people up. We're talking about drama. We're talking about the theater and the stage. Think of Hollywood, and I think you'll have the right idea. For some women imitate Hollywood. They practice the mincing motions of dancers. And they conduct themselves in society as if on stage. That is, they go around with voluptuous movements and gliding steps, pretentious voices, and casting languishing glances round. When we're taking our cues from the media, when our children are absorbed into their idols of the stage, oh, it could be of the athletic field. The point is modesty and not trying to look like some and act like some actress or jock. You get the idea. Tertullian, also writing in the second century, just after Clement, says, they wear in their gait, and gait as in the way they walk, the same appearance as do the women of the nations, from whom the sense of true modesty is absent. So now he's talking about not just dress, but how people walk. In short, how many women are there who do not earnestly desire to look pleasing to strangers? Who does not, on that very account, take care to have herself painted out, yet denying that she's ever been an object of carnal desire? So we try to make ourselves look attractive to the opposite sex, and then we deny, you know, basically that that's what we're doing. Tertullian spoke strong words. Are we to paint ourselves out so that our neighbors may perish? What happened to you will love your neighbor as yourself? Here he recognizes that the way we dress and make ourselves out can cause our neighbor to fall. That's not acting in love. He continues, let a holy woman, if naturally beautiful, give no one such an occasion for carnal lust. Certainly, if she is beautiful, she should not show off her beauty, but should rather obscure it. What an interesting thought. He's saying if it's a Christian sister who's just naturally beautiful, she wakes up that way. She doesn't need makeup. Okay. He says, don't let her give anyone a reason to lust. You know, as Jesus said, things that cause people to sin, they will come, but woe to the one through whom they come, Luke 17. Better to have a millstone tied around the neck and be thrown into the sea. So this beautiful Christian woman, and I think it applied just as well to a handsome Christian brother, should not be showing this off, but there should be modesty. Tertullian also says, whatever is born is the work of God. So whatever is plastered on is the devil's work. How unworthy of the Christian name it is to wear a fictitious face. You on whom simplicity in every form is enjoined, you to whom lying with a tongue is not lawful, you are lying in appearance. Now, I don't necessarily go along with them that, you know, whatever is plastered on is the devil's work, because even wearing clothes, I mean, clothes aren't natural in one sense. Think of the garden scene in Genesis. But that's Tertullian's position. But this thought that we're deceiving, or we're trying to deceive, and Christians are supposed to be people of truth, right? And one more passage from Tertullian. Your dress should not in any way attract attention because of extravagance or artificiality. Otherwise, Christian modesty may be scandalized. I think what he's getting at is that the gospel itself can be discredited. God's people will, instead of attracting those to God in the right sense of attraction, will put them off. And here he refers specifically to extravagance, you know, just overdoing it, perhaps very expensive clothing, very showy, and artificiality. Okay, we move into the 200s. A few more passages. Novation says, "She is not a modest woman who strives to stir up the fancy of another, even though her physical chastity is preserved." I'll pause there. He said, even if she herself is not being promiscuous, she's not technically doing anything, but she's not innocent if she causes others to lust. And the Novation asks, why is the color of the hair changed? Why are the edges of the eyes darkened? Why is the face molded by art into a different form? Why are the necks oppressed and hidden by outlandish stones? He's talking about jewelry. The prices of these, without any workmanship, exceed the entire estate of many persons. See, there's a social conscience to wear expensive clothing when for many people, you know, that would be a year's sustenance. That would be 6 months' salary. Is insensitive. Why identify ourselves with the world in that way? So, again, modesty is more than just clothing. He refers to the hair and makeup, and he refers also to jewelry. Another writer in the 200s, Commodianus, says that the adornment of vanity is fitting for women who haunt the brothels. O modest women of Christ, overcome the evil one. So, he's speaking against vanity. You know, this obsession with how we look, and certainly we need to look very differently than do the immoral. Cyprian, mid-second century. Cyprian of Carthage, North Africa. But self-control and modesty do not consist only in the purity of the flesh, but also in the seemliness and in modesty of dress and adornment. So again, clothes make the man, clothes make the woman. We need to take that seriously. Cyprian also says, the characteristics of jewelry, garments, and the allurements of beauty are not fit for anyone except prostitutes and immodest women. All of these things the sinning and apostate angels put forth by their arts. And here he's referring to the Jewish traditions that some of the angels themselves were sexually promiscuous or immoral, mating with humans. And he's saying that jewelry, garments, he means here the extravagant garments and allurements of beauty, things designed to arouse lust in men. He says they're fitting for prostitutes, not for modesty. Now, I want to read just one last passage before we see where this all leads. And this is actually from outside the period I've been focusing on. It's actually about 200 years later, but it's in the late 300s. It's about 200 years after the first passage I read, and it's called the Apostolic Constitutions. It's not by the apostles, but it shows us the attitude the church had even after things cooled down and the church made peace with the world when the Roman Empire embraced the church. And that was in the early 300s. So this is a few decades later, but still, listen. First to men. Do not adorn yourself in such manner that you might entice another woman to you. Do not further enhance the beauty that God and nature have bestowed on you. Rather, modestly diminish it before others. Therefore, do not permit the hair of your head to grow too long. Do not wear overly fine garments. Now, what's long hair, obviously, in one culture may not be in another. So it's all relative, admitted. But look what he's saying here, that we shouldn't, we should be very careful about enhancing the looks that God has given us. You know, how many men spend so much time looking at themselves in a mirror and turning this way and that way and flexing and spending time at the gym? Health is great. And if we will eat healthily and make sure we're active and fit, we'll live longer, we'll be able to share the gospel with more people. Our body is a temple of the Holy Spirit. That's great. But doing it just to impress other people? Whoa, we've got to watch out with that. Here, the apostolic constitution suggests that we should do the opposite. We should really play it down. So, brother, if you've got huge biceps, how about not wearing such a tight shirt, but being modest? And then to the women, we read, do not add adornments to your beauty in order to please other men. Do not wear fine embroidery garments or shoes to entice those who are allured by such things. It may be that you do not do these wicked things for the purpose of sinning yourselves, but for the sake of adornment and beauty. Nevertheless, you still will not escape future punishment for having compelled another to look so close at you as to lust after you. I think we need to think about this. And I bring this up because, to speak quite frankly, even among Christian people, many churches where I have visited in North America, in Europe, other parts of the world, some of the sisters are dressed in a way, and maybe they're just oblivious, but in a way that excites lust. So let's move into areas for serious reflection as we bring this to a conclusion. First, evangelistic witness. I think the question that we need to ask is, does the way that I dress enhance the gospel? You know, does it make the gospel attractive, or is it just making me attractive? There's a similar passage in Titus 2 when Paul's telling, you know, that the young men need to behave in a certain way. What needs to be adorned is not ourselves, it's the gospel. Evangelistic witness. Are we pursuing holiness or just happiness? Do we have any idea how the Muslim world looks at us? More than 20% of the world follow the Prophet Muhammad, and so many of them, majority of them, look at the loose sexual mores of Western culture. They identify that with Christianity, and we're giving them an excuse to reject Jesus before they've even heard the truth about him. Evangelistic witness. Consider the impact of how we dress and prepare for our day, what we do. Consider the impact on children who are watching, even our own children and grandchildren. Another area for reflection is our use of resources. Does it really honor the Lord to spend so much time working on my appearance, to spend all that money that could have been used for things that were more worthy? Or just the focus, the energy. We only have so much emotional energy. Thinking about appearance, worrying about what other people see, longing to be younger, denying the inevitable process of aging, buying into the youth culture that surrounds us, that's a waste of resources. How would Jesus dress? Well, what can we glean from the few scriptures that there are, and there are not really many, but some do shed light on how he was, his personal attire and appearance. Apparently, he wore nothing radical or garish. There's no comment about that. We know he wasn't particularly wealthy. We remember the scene where the soldiers are gambling for his garment when he's being executed. We can assume that Jesus wore clothes that were appropriate, just normal clothes, appropriate to his station in life, for his age, for his work. If he was doing the manual labor in which he was trained, I doubt he was wearing a very long robe that would be getting in the way. It's common sense. And Jesus taught us in Matthew 6 not to obsess over youth. Didn't he say that in so many words? Am I wrong? You know, he said, which of you by worrying can add a single hour to his life? We're trying to, you know, stop father time. We're trying to be younger, or at least be frozen, not get any older or more decrepit. Jesus said, stop it. Stop worrying about these things. That's what the pagans do. They worry about what they eat and what they drink and what they wear, and God will take care of us. Conclusions. High exposure to programs normalizing immodesty tends to numb the conscience. In our culture, so many programs make immodesty, innuendo, sometimes it's not even innuendo, it's just crass language, seem the norm. Sexual perversion is portrayed as being normative. and we see these things or we hear these song lyrics over and over, and the conscience is numbed, and we forget Christian modesty. We must make choices about what we're going to view and listen to and read. You see, it's not just what we put on in the morning. It's our relationship to the world. For we are to be in the world, but not of the world. Am I drawing excessive attention to myself? Or is my aim to lift up Christ, to make Him more visible, or to make myself more visible? And that's a great question. And that will help you decide the answer to many questions. Not just should I wear this dress or should I buy this suit, but should I get this tattoo or piercing? Should I put on this kind of makeup? Should I do this to my hair? So you have to answer that question. Am I drawing excessive attention to myself, or is it all for Him? Is it all for Jesus? Because Christians are called to live differently from the world. Immodesty and vanity are sinful. We should strive, as did the early church, and as Jesus clearly taught, and Paul and the apostles, we should strive for God's standard of holiness. Not for immodesty, but for modesty, propriety, for holiness.